1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of the Murray's Monday Podcast. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Craig Mauger, Lauren Gibbons, Jacob Kanzler, Simon Schuster, and our old friend Stu Sandler from, no, it's not Decider Strategies.
Grand River anymore. Strategies.
Hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good to be here.
We've got a busy day to talk about several issues. The first one is the special House election that's going to be taking place tomorrow. Todd Corser, Cindy Gamrat. Did either of them have a chance to?
Well, thankfully, we had daylight savings, so we got an extra hour so we could watch Todd Corser's farewell speech via email. No.
You watched it, didn't you? All 20 minutes of it?
Him talking in his car? I hit play, and then I stopped at 30 seconds in going, why are you doing this? I think both of them will not win their respective primaries.
You know, that's funny that you took 30 seconds, because that's exactly what happened to me, too. When I first got it, I listened to the first 30 seconds, and I'm like, no, I want to watch the World Series. And then when I woke up this morning, I actually soldiered through all 20 minutes of it. I know Craig Mauger soldiered through all 20 minutes of it. There wasn't anything new in there, though, was there?
No, it was kind of like him reading one of his emails that he sent off before, but it was confined to 20 minutes, and sometimes the emails take a lot longer than that to read through.
I thought maybe the more interesting part was when he talked about his wife being on 2020 with him, and then the other thing that I thought was interesting was he talked about the theater of democracy, that he considered Lansing to be the theater of democracy. But even that is something that he's kind of talked about before.
I was waiting to see if he was going to explain why he was in a car, parked car. But it never came. That's kind of why I kept watching. Why is he in this car?
You know, I think there's two things there. One, in terms of the 2020, I don't think there's anyone in America who needs to know more about this story. And when it comes to the theater of democracy, I think that's always been his problem. He's always viewed this as a game. He's always viewed it as a theater. You know, he hasn't viewed it as the respected institution it is, and that's why what happened to him, that's what happened in his fate.
Is there any chance that you think that either of them have of winning, Craig?
I don't think former Rep Corser has any chance of winning in the 82nd district. I think former Rep Gamrat may have a very, very small chance of winning in the 80th. But if you look at how these races are playing out, and Stu can probably speak to this, the attacks aren't really being aimed at Gamrat and Corser right now. And it kind of shows you that no one's viewing them as a real threat at this point. If you saw Whiteford's story, outside groups really attacking Cindy Gamrat, former Rep Gamrat must be doing pretty well because they want to go after her. But no one's going after her at this point that heavily.
I think Craig's right. They're not part of the conversation because they're not really credible to win this.
I think then the first in the Corser district, I would agree with you. I don't think he has any chance at all. I think his political career is done. But I find it interesting, though, in that district that there are some really good candidates in that race to split up the vote. And the winner of that election could only get between 15 and 20%. You've got two tiers. I think Gary Howell and Jan Peabody, I think, would be in the top tier. But Ian Kempf and this Tuskegee guy are also really good candidates. And that Adams guy, just from watching him in that debate, I don't think he's that bad either. So I think this is going to get carved up a lot of different ways. But at the end of the day, Corser still needs to get votes. And I don't know how you get votes running a campaign based on emails and sending out video messages from your car.
It doesn't appear that he's doing door-to-door. I mean, if you watch the video message, he talked mostly about how he was sending out these emails. And if you're going to win a race like this in Lapeer County with so many candidates on the ballot, you got to get in front of voters. And that doesn't mean being in front of them on a computer screen with a video message you recorded in your car.
You know, I've talked to a few candidates, and you're as likely to find a voter for Corser as you are to find the Great Pumpkin in that district. It's just you're not finding people supporting him.
On the Gamrat race, I think the opposite has kind of happened, and it's kind of to her detriment in the fact that you've got two candidates who I think have really kind of stood out here, with Whiteford and Story being in the top tier. And then she's got a problem, too, in that she's got a Tea Party advocate running against her that's going to siphon off votes.
Yeah, Bill Sage. It will be interesting to see how she does in comparison to Bill Sage. And once again, If this were an election that was taking place coinciding with a bigger statewide November election, maybe Corser and Gamrot would have a little bit more of a chance because some voters would say, oh, we'll send them back. But these are going to be people going to the polls, probably angry about what they did and casting votes out of that anger against them. So I think that's really going to hurt her.
Simon Schuster has been taking a look at the local elections that are going to be on the ballot tomorrow. And Simon, there are no countywide proposals in either of these districts, is there?
No, there are not. Most of the proposals are directed at public school districts and small public safety millage increases.
So let's just start with Allegan County. What is going to be on the ballot for voters there?
Well, there's several millage-related proposals for a number of school districts, including Delton, Kellogg, Martin. And there's also some funding increases for the fire departments in Lake Town Township and the city of Otsego, as well as their police.
Okay, and then in Lapeer, we have two ballot proposals from what I understand, one in Lapeer and one in Imlay City?
Yeah, that's correct, and they're both related to roads and sidewalks. Lapeer is looking to raise about $500,000, and Imlay is only looking for about a quarter of that. So there's not a lot of proposals that are going to be bringing out voters.
So they want to raise taxes in Lapeer at the same time Todd Corser is running on the platform of not raising taxes for the roads.
Well, I mean, you know, with roads deteriorating and there's not a lot of action going on in the state capital, local municipalities are looking to repair potholes in their own way.
Stu, I want to change gears here a little bit because we've got a couple of ballot proposals that made some news this past week. The first one is this Fair Michigan ballot proposal, which is not looking to amend Elliot Larson, but actually put in protections for gays and lesbians, transgendered individuals into the Constitution. I know you haven't looked really hard into this, but what do you give the prospects of something like this passing in November?
You know, I don't, like I said before we start, I haven't seen the language. The interesting thing to me is the proponents of this issue who are arguing whether or not it makes smart strategy to put this into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's a real hard gamble when you take something like an issue like this and put it into the Constitution, because there's so many possible legal consequences that you don't know at the end of the day if voters are going to support you or not. So I think one of the leading proponents of this issue, Jim Murray, basically said, you might set this back, and I'm paraphrasing him, but if I remember this quote right, it was, you might set this issue back decades by trying to accomplish this. So it's going to be interesting to see how the actual coalition would move forward if they are going to move forward, because I'm not sure everybody was involved in this process.
Because, Lauren, you could have, initially here, you have some hesitancy, and is it basically because of the transgendered issue and maybe folks being just concerned about is voters really willing to go that next extra step to put this into the Constitution?
I think where some of the hesitation lies in some members of the LGBT community, if this loses, making a legislative argument to, you know, amend Elliot Larson after, if they lose, would just, you know, it would set the issue back decades, as I think you said, Stu, because if voters vote against this, that's the argument. You know, you can't bring it up in the legislature. It's like, the voters said no, we're not going to do this if the voters say no. So I feel like a lot of the LGBT community that isn't on board with potentially putting this out there would prefer to see, you know, potential changes in the legislature, like maybe a more friendly house after 2016. And that's something that they could work with a little bit more easier. But it's, you know, it's just a, like you said, a hard gamble to make at this point.
And there are a couple, there's one unknown factor in that we don't know what else is going to be on the ballot, which what else is on the ballot could have an impact on what voters' approach is to these many ballot proposals that are out there. And secondly, when you change the Constitution through a ballot proposal, I think there's a higher bar of support that you need to do that. So instead of just maybe changing Elliot Larson, now they're going to have to hit a higher bar, which who knows if they're going to be able to hit that or not.
Would you equate this, Stu, to either running the ball on the one-yard line with 2 seconds left against the Michigan defense if you're Minnesota, or kicking the field goal and play into an overtime?
Well, I think that Minnesota found that situation was hopeless, so I don't know how I would equate this, but you know, it'll be interesting to see sort of how they strategize and move forward.
All right, another bit of news that happened this past week: the folks who are looking to repeal prevailing wage, the folks who put in up to $1 million to get these signatures, only to have to just flush them right down the toilet. How mad would you be if you were the folks from ABC and the Freedom Fund?
Well, it's definitely disappointing. I mean, they obviously wanted to be on the ballot, and now they're going to have to take another stab at it. You know, one thing they have gained is some of the data you know, those 380,000 signatures are valuable in the process, but it's still, yeah, I haven't really talked to anyone connected with it, but I'm betting they're disappointed.
Because, Jake, this is going to really set things back as far as the timing about when the legislature could take this up. And if this does get on the ballot, you know, there isn't going to be a lot of time to really maneuver here, is there?
Yeah, not from what I've seen before. I mean, so you're starting a new six-month window, presumably as soon as possible. So that's now, and that'll take us all the way through May. June 1st is the deadline, I think, to get signatures to the Board of State Canvassers. Takes them a while to go through them and get something to certify. Then you have the legislature has it for 40 days. Then right around September, if I remember correctly last time we did this, there's a date that the Secretary of State says we need to know what's going to be on the ballot. So right. I don't know how much of a time crunch there is. I don't know how much flexibility the Secretary of State has to move back deadlines to allow the legislature to consider it for 40 days. So there's obviously a lot of questions as to how this is going to work out.
Well, I think they clearly have the resources to do it, and they clearly have the, you know, the organization to do it. And they seem like they're choosing to do it. So I'd imagine if they're going to put their resources towards it, it'll get on the ballot.
Also, looking ahead to 2016, you've done a lot of consulting for Congressman Mike Bishop. It looks like the Democrats are actually putting forth a candidate they think is going to have some mileage and could give Mike Bishop a good run in 2016. How are you kind of viewing this challenger in our former Little House on the Prairie star, Melissa Gilbert?
Well, as anyone who's talked to me about this race knows, the first thing I think Melissa Gilbert should focus on is paying her own taxes. I was down in D.C. Last week, and, there's definitely a view that Congressman Bishop is in a strong position to win re-election. I mean, the district is a favorable Republican district. Congressman Bishop is well-liked by leadership, and he's well-liked by this Republican caucus. And he's running some strong legislation, his mobile workforce tax bill. He just is working with the Lansing Airport to get the Lansing to D.C. route back to the airport. So, you know, he's doing a lot of good things. Melissa Gilbert, there are some people who recognize, you know, she was a celebrity. She's got some Hollywood money coming towards her. But that tax issue is a very big issue. And frankly, I think she made a big faux pas in having her husband contribute $5,400 to her campaign. You know, the campaign says they're going to paying their taxes as soon as they can. Regular people think $5,000 going to a political campaign versus going to paying your back taxes isn't enough. And I would challenge any county treasurer in that district to come up with someone who owes more taxes in that area, including the former county treasurer who ran against Mike Bishop, Eric Schertzing. I wonder how Eric Schertzing feels about her not paying her taxes.
Well, you would have to say, though, as far as name ID, I mean, this is a pretty good get, though, for the Democratic Party. Here we've got somebody who's been on TV. She's well known. And this is somebody that they feel like they could get some real traction with.
You know, with celebrity candidates, they start out with a little bit of buzz. But if you look at people like George Clooney's father, if you look at people like Ashley Judd, once people pull back the veneer and actually find out there's a candidate underneath, it becomes pretty challenging. And for someone, again, their introduction to Melissa Gilbert is she hasn't paid $500,000 of her own back taxes and won't pay them for another 10 years. So it's going to take 20 years for her to pay taxes when she's actually made some decent money. It's shocking to think that voters would support that.
On another front here, Stu, you've probably paid attention to these presidential debates, have you not?
I have.
You have a favorite candidate in this, don't you?
I have given money to Jeb Bush, and I am supporting him. But I would say this, watching these debates, it's really missing an opportunity to take 16 or now 15, or is it 14? I don't even remember how many there are. But, you know, when the stage is normally 10 or 11, and you have really candidates with some real serious backgrounds, and they ask them all these dumb, unique, personal questions, you know, about like one moment in their life. You know, Ted Cruz, you had a paper out when you were 16, and you gave money to someone who didn't, you know, do this. How does that make you feel? I think they're missing a real opportunity to talk about some of the real serious issues in the nation.
Well, you got to admit, though, that there are some questions voters have out there, and you do, as the media, have to prod them to make these debates interesting. They're long enough as it is, 2.5 hours, and you want to get folks engaged in conversation.
And that's,
right?
I think, one of the first problems with these debates are they've been too long. I mean, that 3-hour debate was almost impossible to watch. I think I might have been the only person that watched it from beginning to end. You know, and frankly, they're not even treating their candidates right. From last night, when I heard the campaigns went in, we're saying like the rooms are like 85 degrees. You got to treat the candidates with some level of respect. But beyond that,
It was remarkable to watch the CNBC debate, because in 2012, they did such a good job in Michigan of having a real focused debate, and it was really substance-oriented. Then you watch that fiasco, and just even the way, I mean, they open up so personal and so, I mean, yeah, you have to answer voters' questions, but there are a lot of policy-oriented questions that aren't being asked. I mean, all this kind of unique gotcha stuff, it's almost like, you know, sort of a junior high prodding one person to fight with another. And, I was joking, it's kind of like that, you know, the movie Mean Girls, that three-way call where, you know, one of them's on and goes, hey, didn't you say this about Ben Carson? And then jump off the line and have Trump defend himself.
Well, the prior debate was like that. Well, I think
that's what I was
so
interested in Stu's perspective on. The CNN debate, it seemed like the last one, seemed like it was more what you're describing. Yeah. This person said this about you 4 years ago. What's your response to that? Yeah. At CNBC, there were a couple questions that seems like maybe they should have been weeded out. Why do you think CNBC is taking such a hit here?
Because I think after the third debate, now that people are getting closer and really have to make a decision, voters are getting tired of this. They really do want to see, you know, because you have some outsider candidates who people don't know a lot about Ben Carson. People don't know about where Donald Trump stands on these issues. They really want to know because there are a lot of people considering them. And to put up with some of the juvenile questions, I think voters are getting angry and the candidates are getting angry.
Some of the candidates obviously made a strategic decision to attack the media during that debate. Do you think that's a strategy that wins? I'm really curious.
It works, and it works in Republican primaries. And frankly, if you look at the candidates who are ahead right now, one of the reasons I think they're ahead is because they are successfully attacking the media. And frankly, the biggest applause lines that night were Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio attacking the media. So I think it's a successful strategy. And frankly, the media has put themselves in that position.
So what do you think is going to happen now with these future debates? I mean, they're still going to go forward. We're going to have another one on the 10th. Do you think we're going to see more substantive debates? It's going to be on the Fox Business Channel. So I would presume that they're going to have the gotcha questions turned down a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going to happen again. I wasn't in the room last night with the campaigns, but it seems like they were all in agreement. Something has to change or the candidates won't participate. And that'll cause change quickly.
Jeb Bush now. You are a Jeb Bush supporter, like you said initially. How does he get back into this?
Well, I mean, one thing is he clearly has the resources, and he's clearly got a great record and a great amount of experience. You know, one of the things that challenges him is there is such a heightened view of these debates, and he's just frankly, he hasn't performed well in them. That's not abnormal to candidates. There are some candidates, like one of the candidates who's performed really well in debate-like settings is Hillary Clinton. You take her to the average voter, she doesn't connect, but you take her to a debate and she knocks it out of the park. In the same respect, I think Jeb Bush has struggled. That campaign has a lot of smart people, and I think he's, you know, well-built to have a strategy in some of these early states and actually the March states that, you know, this is going to be, a long race. I don't think anyone's going to win this in the first couple of races, in the first couple of primaries. So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they respond to it. But he's definitely had a challenging week.
He's not going to drop out by Christmas, is he?
I can't imagine that. I think, you know, you'll see over the next couple of weeks, you know, Jeb Bush sort of reemerge as a candidate. I mean, right now you have this sort of top tier where you have Carson and Trump, who seem to have just a real big cushion of voters, but a lot of voters, frankly, want to know more about them. And then you have this, you know, group where it looks like Cruz, Bush, and Rubio, where if you look at the polling, they're all sort of, you know, hovering around each other. And I think, you know, there's a lane for either Rubio or Bush to come out of. I think there's a lane for Cruz and there's a lane for Carson or Trump. And I think you'll see different voters react to them differently. So I think Bush still has a chance.
So Rubio and Bush are fighting for the same lane, it seems like. I mean, one of them's going to fall out probably much earlier than the other one.
Yeah. And, Rubio's people have run a smart race, but also you read articles. And again, I'm just reading articles. I don't know a lot of this firsthand, but it looks like they don't have as well-built an organization in some of the early states as Jeb does. That being said, there's still a lot of time for them to foster up. They've obviously performed well in these early, in these debates. And, you know, there definitely is this sort of, the media's thought that Rubio will perform well. So it'll be interesting to see sort of over the next couple of months who emerges. But you are getting into the point, once you get to Thanksgiving, voters really are going to start deciding who they're voting for. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see some of this fluctuation stop.
Who did you dress up as for Halloween, Stu?
That's a personal question.
Man. I know somebody in this room dressed up as a dancing pumpkin, and we may have seen a jig on Saturday night.
You don't have to be anonymous about it. It was me. I had a mask on, but it was cool.
And if anybody wants to see the jig, it's on your Facebook page, isn't it?
I have a picture. There are videos that can be made available.
There are videos.
Actually, I think
did you post them, Lauren?
Oh, I haven't posted his yet, but I'm sure. Well, we've all got them.
Actually, it's my very last tweet. The last tweet I had. I tweeted it out after the Lions game.
I knew I saw it somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yes. So if you want to take a look at a dancing pumpkin, just go to Jacob's.
In a unitard. You might want to warn people.
Craig is using
not just pantyhose, but a unitard.
Craig is using, no, those are all the wrong terminology, actually. It's a black suit. I don't know how else to describe it.
No, it's not a suit. It's not a suit.
It's a skin suit.
You need to do something to cheer us up after the Lions loss. So.
Hey, you were performing a public service.
I mean,
and those pantyhose legs I had will only get you so far.
The story behind this, and anyone that needs background, just Google Dancing Pumpkin Man.
Why don't you put a 10,000 word email out about this?
I don't need that many words. We discovered this man on the internet, and the dance brought me a lot of joy, so I was like, I would like to bring this joy to other people at this party. So
that was very thoughtful.
I was fearful. I thought you were bringing fear to people.
That's not the right response.
I mean, when you're calling a unitard a skin suit, that's all. I would rather say unitard than skin suit. That sounds like something.
I don't know what it's called, but you can decide for yourself when you watch it.
Jacob Kanzler, that's his Twitter handle. Just go ahead and find it, and there it will be. And actually, for the record, I think that your costume actually better than the original Dancing Pumpkin. I liked your costume better.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, the mask looked fit better.
Thank you so much.
His was too small, I think.
That is probably true.
Yeah, okay.
The swell of Twitter followers that are going to come to you. It's just mind-blowing.
So with that, we're going to sign off here for the rest of the crew here. Thanks for Stu for stopping by. I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.